Hey, Chickapees, Adam Carolla here. Look, I don't listen to tech podcasts often. In fact, I never do. But when I do, I listen to Speaking in Tech. Greg, Eddie, and Sarah are sort of the Three's Company of tech podcasts. Well, except none of them are as hot as Chrissy. Tune in and get your geek on every week with Speaking in Tech. Love you guys.
Podcasting from Cleveland, Austin, and beyond, welcome to Speaking in Tech,
where enterprise tech meets consumer tech.
With your host, Greg Nierman, his trusty sidekick, Eddie Seipet, and keeping them honest, Sarah Bella.
Sit back and get comfortable. It's time to get your geek on with Speaking in Tech.
While taxing our way into another episode of Speaking in Tech on the Register, thank you for joining us. And this week, Eddie is somewhere in Thailand, but Sarah is with us. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good. I'm back.
You should be relaxed. You were in Florida last week, so you're well rested.
Yeah, we had a great time. I went to St. Pete Beach to visit my sister and also just take a little vacation with the girls, and it was just really, really nice. That is a beautiful beach, and we spent a lot of time in the water, and I really needed that. So,
hey, did you happen to see Eddie's news?
Yeah, I did. I caught that.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week. Eddie's getting hitched.
Are we going to podcast live from the wedding? I think we should.
I'm working on that. We're negotiating that right now. So I think it's a definite possibility.
Congrats to Eddie. I basically hate weddings, but I might be convinced to go to that one.
Well, it's not about, it's not really about the wedding. It really is about the reception and us being able to podcast.
Exactly. If you can find a good reason for us to be there, then I'll be there.
Absolutely. Well, we did miss you, Sarah. I will tell you, there's just something missing when you're not here on the show. I miss you. I'm sure Eddie misses you,
me,
too.
Me, I'm missing. Yeah. That's something. I miss you guys, too. I'm sorry I couldn't call in from Florida, but it's a good thing that I didn't try to promise to do that, because it would not have worked.
It would not have gone well?
No.
Did you at least have some fruity drinks?
I had one fruity drink when I got there, and it was just gross, and I realized that I am not a fruity drink person, so,
You stuck to the whiskey.
I had some delicious fish, and I did a lot of swimming. It was really, really nice.
Well, fantastic. But you're back, and now we got to jump into the news.
We do. So, and I'm gonna pass this over to you pretty quickly, because I think you've read up on it a little bit more than I have. But apparently Chicago is now taxing consumers for cloud services. Do I get that pretty much right?
I don't know if it's consumers. It's everybody.
Everybody. Like, including the service providers.
That's right. And this looks to me to be pretty unsustainable, is putting it generously. Of course, the tech media took the high road with this and says, oh my God, they're taxing Netflix. But the real story here is that all cloud services agree taxed. And Reed Smith, a law firm that reviewed this, had some findings on this, and it includes cloud services, cloud computing, hosted environment, software as a service, platform as a service.
That's nuts.
Infrastructure as a service. And I looked at the actual, the law, there's a PDF up there that you can read that actually shows the law as they've written it. And they talk about cloud storage is a great example. They're not going to tax you on, for instance, if you host, and again, I'm no expert here, but our resident legal expert, Eddie, is not here, so I'll fill in the best I can. So the best I figure is that you're not taxed on cloud storage like if you would use it in AWS if it's outside of city limits. You're only charged if you access it, which you're not always charged for access, right? So
yes,
I mean if you're an AWS account holder, you absolutely are. But if you've got Google Photos, it's not like you're paying for those Google Photos to come down the pipe.
Right.
But you might be paying your internet company, your internet provider, for that. So does that mean the internet provider now adds a 9%? Does everybody in the food chain of this now get a 9% tax added on?
Well, it would seem so. So and then it gets piled on, and then basically everybody's just going to be done, right? Then we'll give up Netflix. We'll start building things with rocks.
It's not exactly a small tax either. It's a 9% tax.
Yeah.
And when you figure what AWS costs and how Azure and others are coming down in costs, that 9% kind of sticks out a little bit, I think.
I guess my question is, how is the city going to create the infrastructure to be able to track all this stuff and actually tax it? It's not like gasoline or cigarettes. It's complicated. So how on earth are they going to figure that out? That's a crazy logistical nightmare just all by itself.
I think they're going to trust the good people of Chicago to self-report. Well, I think it'll be easy for services like Netflix, right? Because Netflix will just slap it on based on your zip code and add that as a cost of doing business for Netflix, mm-hmm. like you buying a pack of cigarettes or something. I think it's the other services that's going to get a little bit more complicated because it's not exactly straightforward. So I think this is a really bad idea. But, the weird thing is, Sarah, is that these type of things are things like New York will look at this and is like, oh, well, Chicago can do it. We can do it. And then LA says, hey, if New York and Chicago can do this, we can do this. It's a crazy little thing. This is something that could, take on a life of its own.
I do partly sympathize with the fact that cities are struggling a little bit as brick and mortar retail gives way to this kind of shopping experience and purchasing experience online. And they're looking to try to recoup that lost revenue. I understand that that's the motivation, and it makes some sense to me.
From all those tax dollars that left the city when Blockbuster closed?
Exactly. Maybe not Blockbuster, but, Amazon. I mean, if you think about what that's done to cities and to brick and mortar retail, it's pretty serious, right?
Yeah, but I mean, those consumer goods are already bound by obviously a different set of tax codes, right? So this takes it into a different space of services that wasn't taxed at all before, especially when you talk about infrastructure as a service, right? Well, I guess maybe the rationalization there is, well, if I'm not going to buy a data center and put it in my Chicago office and pay sales tax on that when I purchase it, I don't know. That's a stretch, though.
It's all a stretch. We'll see what happens. I'd be curious to see if other cities pick this up.
Yeah, if Los Angeles and New York are going to sniff around at this.
Sure. I think other cities. Why not Houston? Why not Cleveland?
Cleveland. We're still trying to learn about this.
Cleveland.
We're trying to learn about this thing, this cloud thing, anyway.
Someday I'm going to come up to Cleveland and visit you and tour all my old haunts if there's any left. I haven't been there in decades.
There's a couple left,
I'm sure. So, in other news, I think really the biggest news, at least so far today, so far this week, is the hacking team based in Italy was hacked in a big way. And I know you're following this, but this is an amazing story. And I really think the article that you found, Greg, is actually my favorite so far, which is on CSO. So that's a great place to start, and a lot of pretty frightening and amazing screenshots from what they found. So anyway, they took over. So Hacking Team is this sort of supplier to governments all over the world and other organizations all over the world of kind of aggressive hacking systems. And they've always said that they, that they don't engage with customers, that they don't have clients who are, I can't remember exactly how they put it, but that they refuse to work with clients who don't respect human rights or something like that.
They pretend not to work with the bad boys.
Mm-hmm. And then now here's the screenshot of, Sudan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia.
Take your pick.
It's starting to look a little. And they're trying to backtrack now. And, Ethiopia, which I don't know, there's a lot of very credible evidence that looks like they actually supported Ethiopia's efforts to go after journalists. It's pretty scary stuff. Hacked the Twitter account. Amazing, right? And we don't have Eddie, our resident security expert, to talk about what happened here. But what are your thoughts on this? This is, to me, amazing.
Well, first of all, it's kind of funny. The hacker gets hacked. And things like this are inevitable. But it's amazing the depth that they've gone through. And there's all kinds of back and forth. Well, one of the first things is that the security experts on the legitimate security experts on Twitter were warning everybody, don't open this file unless you have it in a virtual machine because it was just laced with viruses itself. So, I mean, just to get to the information was a bit complicated from what I understand. But the information that's out there is pretty damning. And some there's this article doesn't cover, but I saw another article about just how bad the hackers' passwords were. I mean, of all people.
Oh, no, it's in here. It's the same guy, but he had a follow-up article. The passwords are like password, but the O is a zero. Even I'm not that bad.
But there was one good point that came out of this is that if you have a jailbroken iPhone – the lesson here is that those jailbroken iPhones can get hacked where a regular iPhone that's not been broken can't be hacked. Mm-hmm. So there's some little kernels being learned here. Now, Android's like a sieve, apparently, from some of the other articles I've seen. But we've kind of known that for a while. But the one lesson here is don't jailbreak your iPhone, among other lessons.
I think there's a lot.
Did you see how much money they were making too? I think what is this? $4 million.
Millions and millions and millions of euros.
€4 million.
4.3 million from. And here's just a short list of some countries that they've supported: Oman, South Korea, United Arab Emirates, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Lebanon, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, Brazil, Singapore, Egypt, Vietnam, Sudan, Russia.
What the hell is Mongolia doing on this list? Who are they spying on?
I thought that was fascinating. I don't even know. I don't understand Mongolia.
Aren't they part of China?
Well, we should get my son on here. Maybe we'll have him as a guest sometime and he'll explain it all to us because he could go on forever. The Ethiopia thing, to me, that was really super scary. That's in the follow-up article, but they basically, you know, denied ever working with Ethiopia after there was a report released about this group helping Ethiopia track down journalists. And then, it turns out that they did, in fact, work with Ethiopia. So they probably did help this government.
It's funny. They get the list of customers.
Track down journalists.
In this list of customers they have, they got like Russia and Sudan. And there's notes, not officially supported. There must be out of contract.
Well, I think it's – I take that to be – well, I don't know. I didn't know how to read that. Some are active, some are expired, and then this not officially supported to me was code for, like, we don't talk about this country ever to anybody.
Yeah, which is interesting. Anyway.
Creepy.
Very creepy. What else we got?
So Google is rolling out this service through the navigation app that they own, the Waze navigation app. And also through another app called Ride With, which is a ride sharing app this is in Israel. So they're rolling out a service that allows for people to use Waze to do ride sharing. But they're very, very careful to say that this is not a direct Uber competitive. And they've set it up in such a way that it's super limited to commuters and ride sharers. So the drivers, for example, can only do two drives a day or have two passengers twice a day to and from work. And then there's a few other restrictions on there that you can't pay. You can only pay for gasoline and wear and tear. You can't actually pay like a taxi fee like you would for a cab or for an Uber.
And those fees are all automated in the app itself, which is fantastic, right? Because there's no negotiating and there's no, hey, if you're coming along for the ride, here's what it is. This is fantastic.
I'm still curious. I'm curious to know what the drivers do get out of it. Did you get a sense of, is there any other article that shows exactly what a driver will make?
Well, what does the ride sharers get? You know those signs, I don't know if you have them in Texas, but I know in California and Ohio, you got ride share signs and you call an 800
number.
Yeah,
we don't have those here.
So in a lot of states, you can coordinate ride shares. It's kind of, a way to be more energy efficient. And what's brilliant about this is what does Uber spend most money on right now? On lobbying governments.
Legal
fees, right. Getting these laws changed. Rather than fight that and create a whole new system, they're saying, all right, ride sharing's already here. Nobody makes a buck on this except for Google. I guess Google gets their cut of the pie on this. But it's convenient. You got similar benefits to Uber as long as you've got enough obviously rideshares participating in this. This is a fantastic kind of a sidebar thing. It'd be interesting to see what happens.
Right, sidebar thing. But it doesn't make sense for Uber. I mean, it's so specific and it's so rideshare and commuter focused that you wouldn't take it to the airport. You wouldn't take it, you know,
after a night out at the bar.
And drivers aren't going to be as motivated. You've got people. What you'll have is commuters who want to make a few extra bucks, maybe, who are already driving to work. But you won't have this whole fleet of people who are interested in making money by being Uber and Lyft drivers.
No, there's no financial advantage, right?
Mm-mm, I don't think so. So that's why I'm curious. I'm curious to know what it would be worth to a driver to participate in this. But anyway, interesting.
I would think that it would cut into what their cost for driving to work every day is, right? So if they're spending, you know, let's say $50 a week in gas, that would mm-hmm. offset it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's cheaper for the rideshares than you know, using... You know, maybe this isn't taking on Uber directly. Maybe I'm looking at this all wrong.
Maybe I don't think so.
It's just as simple as a ride-sharing app.
I really think it is. And that doesn't mean that Google isn't ever going to take on Uber. But to me, and maybe this is one sort of experiment towards that goal, but this doesn't feel at all like an Uber killer or even an Uber poker.
It's got all the risks of Uber without the protections.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Have you ever done a ride share? Would you ever get in a car with a stranger?
Never do a ride share. Not in a million years. I don't even like taking the bus. This is not a service for me. I hate taking the bus. You've seen the RTA buses here in Cleveland.
Greg, all those dirty people.
It's not about the dirty people. It's just that, you know, every 5 seconds you got to stop someplace. And you're like, I just want to get to downtown.
Yeah.
But that
wouldn't happen in a ride share. You would get to downtown.
That's true. But I don't... Look, my commute is from my bedroom to my home office when I'm in town, so I don't think I can get ride sharing for that. Although that would be an interesting option.
Me too. Austin is so strangely set up, and you know it was never really designed in a way that made sense for commuters to begin with. That I don't. That's why ride sharing doesn't really happen here, is because there's just so many different communities and so many different places that people work that. I just don't think there's as an obvious route for, bedroom communities into the city and back out again as there are in other cities.
You got all those bike lanes, right? So who takes a car anyway?
I couldn't ride my bike to Dell, I'll tell you that. It wouldn't work. No. But some people do.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic, Sarah. Thank you very much. And right after this break, we're going to be bringing on a very special friend of mine, Jason Krusan from NASA, right after this.
So exciting.
The Gemini space flights. The trips are long. The training is hard, like this spacewalk practice. But the astronauts do some things you do. In space, they drank Tang. They mixed it like this in a zero-G pouch, because with no gravity, it would fly all over. You don't have that problem. You can mix it in a glass. Up there, they have to drink it carefully, this way. You can drink it any way you like. Tang tastes orangey. Tastes great. Has lots of vitamins C and A. Tang, chosen for the Gemini astronauts. Have a blast. Have some Tang.
Well, there you go. Sarah, did you have Tang as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
I think there's something there's something definite about ages, right? I think if you're probably under 30, you've probably never even heard of Tang. And if you're
well,
over
you maybe
30,
have heard of it, but you've definitely not ever had it.
And no, and especially back in the days where the astronauts were pimping Tang.
Yep. Well, for those for the kids listening, you really aren't missing anything. It was pretty awful.
It tasted like orange.
Yeah, it was like sweet orange flavored water. It was pretty bad.
It was pretty bad. Well, let's introduce our very special guest this week. It's Jason Krusan. Jason is the Director of Advanced Exploration Systems Division at NASA. Jason, thank you so much for coming on. You were a guest back in the old days for InfoSmack. It's been a while since we've talked.
No, thanks for having me, guys.
And there's a little story behind this. Jason, I've known Jason for years. Jason and I were in the same fraternity. We went to the same school. I think I was in graduate school, Jason, when you were in undergrad, because I'm a little bit older than you.
Yeah, that's probably about right. Probably my first undergrad that I was finishing up there at the same school. So
yeah, and I wasn't too mean to you, was I?
No, not too bad. No. Not too much hazing back in those days.
Did he give you a wedgie, Jason?
No, I don't remember anything like that.
Nothing like that. So, Jason, obviously, last time you were on, which is eons ago, we talked about kind of your career development at NASA, and you're a lifer there. How many years have you been at NASA?
Yeah, I started actually almost 20 years ago at this point. So 1996.
Wow. And are you still as – I mean, I can imagine that when you first started at NASA, you know, eyes big, you're working for NASA. How cool is that? Every kid's dream. Do you still have that little fire in your belly that you had when you first started?
Yeah. I mean, like any job, it gets on you at times. But then ever so often, or actually pretty often, you get out and you talk to others, talk to kids, and you see that fire in them, and that kind of re-energizes you and gets you going to get back in the office the next day and – keep on building the space program.
You've got this really impressive title, Advanced Exploration Systems Division at NASA. What does that do? What does your role encompass?
So I work in our human spaceflight group. So all the things that you see about humans flying in space to the space station and all that. Our group is one of the main divisions in that group, but we're like the technology arm of the human spaceflight group. And we do a whole host of technology development, building the capabilities we need to actually send humans and let them live in space. And then we also have kind of the architecture planning kind of aspect of it, is like what are the missions that we're going to go do, how are we going to do them, and what's needed to do them. So you can think about it as, what do we need to do things, and then we're actually making the investments to go do it.
That's so fantastic.
Do you have people on your staff who are human psychology or development or physical people on your staff, or is that like a whole separate division? Because yeah, I think that stuff is fascinating.
Yeah, we have another group called the Human Research Program, and they do a lot of like the understanding of biology, the human biology, understanding the psychology of things. That's a sister organization to mine, but we work really closely together because we're the ones designing the habitats, the places where people live, and they tell us how big do those need to be? What are the psychological effects by doing certain things and certain design features in them? So,
Jason, you had a great little write-up in the Washington Post recently, which is really fantastic, and it was great, you know, being a friend of yours to see that. And you covered a number of different areas there. What are some of the big missions that you're working on right now?
Yeah, so we obviously have the space station, and it's running, I mean, 24/7, 365 days a year. We have a permanent crew up there of anywhere from 3 to 6 people all the time. In our enterprise, our whole group, we're sending cargo flights up. We're getting crew rotations right now with the Russians. We're designing new crew vehicles with Boeing and SpaceX to start doing crew launches from the U.S. again. And we're hoping to get that going by 2017, 2018 timeframe. So you'll see crew launches again, but that's kind of ramping up now as test flights are starting to happen on those new vehicles. In fact, I think in the next couple weeks here, we'll name the astronauts that'll be on those first test flights that'll be coming up. And then my specific group, we're doing a whole host of the technology pieces. So we're testing some habitats that we're actually going to send to the space station. We're doing some fire safety demonstrations and next generation software. Well,
what's a fire safety demonstration look like in space?
Yeah, so we obviously you want to know how things burn in space, because fires are really bad, and they're really bad when you can't go anywhere and you're inside of your spacecraft. So in the past, we do these little fire experiments, and they're about burning like material that's the equivalent of like a Post-it note size, 4 inches by 4 inches or so. It's kind of the largest thing we've ever burned in space. If you see those kind of famous videos of flaming candles. You have a normal, here on Earth, you have a kind of a convection. So you have this kind of pointy candle flame. But if you do the same thing in space, it forms a perfectly spherical ball in space when you burn a candle up there. Well, we don't actually know what happens when you set something very large on fire. So we designed an experiment to catch something large on fire, about a meter by a half meter wide article of different materials. We're going to actually do this experiment a couple times. And we're going to do that in space.
How do you do that so it doesn't risk up? I mean, you can't do it like inside the space station, right? You got to do that from some distance.
Yeah. Or do you? Originally, when we proposed the idea, that was obviously the first question people asked, were you going to do this again? The crew was very interested in it.
Yeah, I bet they were.
So luckily, though, we have all these cargo vehicles going to the space station, and one of them is built by a company called Orbital Sciences.
Well, I thought you were going to say SpaceX. easy target.
Yeah, obviously, SpaceX has theirs, but Orbital's is a cargo vehicle that goes up, and we load it after its mission's done, after it delivers its cargo. We fill it up with trash, and it burns up on its reentry when it comes back. So we're actually going to use one of those, and instead of filling it completely full of trash, we'll have an experiment inside of it that what we call things racks, just much like you guys have in the computer industry side, and they're about the same size as a rack of equipment or two racks of equipment, and we'll have one of those mounted inside, and the last thing the crew does before it undocks from the space station is they remove our safety cables and all that kind of stuff that keep it unarmed while it's docked to the space station, and we'll arm the payload to be able to basically be able to command it to turn on or light it on fire. And then after it undocks, we'll get a distance away from the space station, and we'll actually start the fire on purpose at that point.
Wow.
And then obviously film the whole thing in video. And then we'll keep it in orbit about an extra week or so to downlink all the data. It takes us a little bit more time to get all the data down. We don't quite have the bandwidth to get it all down with all that high definition video we want to take.
What's it like working on technology or even the beginnings of technology that you know, like you probably won't see them come to fruition? Or correct me if I'm wrong, like when do you think the stuff that you're working on now will be actually launched?
Yeah, so I mean, we have a mix of things. So I have about 30 some projects, I would say, loosely in my group. And of that, about 70% of it is things that we're actually flying. So my group and my personal choice is to actually flies things in space. We can do a lot of ground testing, but a lot of times we make certain assumptions when you do a test, and the assumptions aren't all that great. And so it's much better just to hurry up and fly it. And because we have pretty routine access to the space station these days, it's better to actually just go fly it, even if you're not going to have a perfect experiment, but rather just go fly and figure out what's going to happen. So a lot of our work does happen pretty quickly. These fire experiments, we started designing them less than 2 years ago, and we'll have a series of three flights over 3 years. Over 2 years, sorry. And then right after that, we're building three more. And those ones were going to design how to detect fire, how to put the fire out, and then how to do the cleanup after a fire occurs.
I guess my question was more like, what is it like knowing that a lot of what you're working towards is something that you'll probably never see? Is that exciting? Is that like vaguely disappointing? Do you look at I think you have children, it said in the article, like, are they excited about maybe being part of that future that they can carry it on? Like, what is that like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think about it, I guess, in my own lifetime. I mean, my first memories were the space shuttle program. Challenger is my first memory of the space shuttle program. So I would say that many in my generation and those around us, space has been something that always existed. So I don't see it as obviously we're heading out towards Mars. We want to send people further and further into space. But to me, it's not about the specific destination, but it's about all those incremental steps to allow us to actually live off the planet for longer and longer periods of time. And it's more about the journey than a specific kind of example. I mean, a specific destination. So it's not like Apollo, in my opinion. Apollo had its goal of setting footprints and flags within 10 years. To me, that's a very narrow kind of view of what human spaceflight is. I mean, today, human spaceflight is about sending humans further and further and staying for longer in space and breaking kind of the logistics from Earth to allow us to actually be, to live off the planet for indefinite periods of time. So it's that journey is actually exciting. So every little step and the fact that we have permanent presence in space for actually for my kids' sake who are under the age of 10, their entire lifetime, people have been living off this planet.
So you got plans to go to Mars. Are we just skipping the moon for now?
So the moon, actually, we're going to still use. So we are sending our first steps of actually sending crews out to Mars are actually going to utilize the moon. The moon's a great testing location. Our first new flight of our Orion crew capsule, which is, you think of an Apollo capsule, but much bigger and obviously with modern technology. We're going to launch that in 2018, and we're actually going to fly it out past the moon and put it into an orbit what they call a distant retrograde orbit, which is out there a little bit further than the moon. And actually looking back at Earth, you'll be able to see the moon and Earth in the same image. And it'll spend 20-some days out there, and it will actually come back then and come back to Earth and land in the Pacific, which is our first time out the gate that we'll be sending a crewed capsule, although the first time we won't have people on it, further than we ever went with the Apollo program, meaning further out into space. So that'll be one of the first things to do. And then that'll be all out there near the moon. And then we're actually going to use that kind of orbit around the moon as our assembly point to where we put everything together to send the spacecraft out to Mars and where we test things, and also as a kind of a parking.
Will that be on the moon or would that be just in space?
In space. Everything has gravity. So if you took it all the way to the surface of the moon, you'd have to have rockets to take it back off the surface. So right. Think about something in space being assembled, much like the space station was assembled in low Earth orbit. It'll be assembled around the moon, and then we'll have engines on it. And at some point when it's ready, we depart on our way to Mars.
So there's no concept of the moon ever being a base station to go further.
So there is interest in looking at the moon for its resources. So we've been, since we did some of our initial planning for Mars, since then we've had a couple missions, one of them called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, another one called L-CROSS, which was an impactor. Our international partners have had a couple missions. And what we found is, what we thought from Apollo is the moon was a very dry environment. It was just dusty dirt and rocks and such. What we found is it's actually very rich in water.
Yeah, I was reading about that you heat it up to a certain temperature and you can extract oxygen and hydrogen and other things out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And water, actually, in most likely in water's form. We've actually seen actual water, H2O, in the polar regions. And some of the scientists out there predict that there's enough water in just one pole. Paul Spoutis, who's a lunar scientist, he did some calculations based on data that he had from a mission called Mini-RF. And it showed that there's enough water in just one pole for the equivalent of a space shuttle launch every day for 2,000 years.
Wow.
So think about that. That's a pretty big resource that you don't have to launch from Earth, that you might be able to gather somewhere else. So even though, yeah, we're building out the habitation systems in orbit around the moon, we are still looking at the moon as a potential resource location to harvest resources, the gases and such to power the engines and all that to send folks out.
Now, Jason, the last time you were on, we talked a little bit about some of the open innovation initiatives that NASA's doing. What do those look like today, and who's participating in those programs?
Yeah, so I think when we last talked, we were kind of in our pilot phase, and now I think we'll fast forward 4 years later or so, and we've ran over 500 or 600 challenges at this point, mainly geared at software. We did a lot of work with the Top Coder community. Now it's Aperio. And we had a huge amount of success in writing software. We've been using it to actually write part of our next generation network protocols. So think TCP/IP, but for space. and so everything that we do today is kind of peer-to-peer networking, which is, you know, that's kind of you have to schedule everything and you want to do direct ties and all that. We want to do a true networking in space, but TCP/IP is a little limiting when your latency gets as high as far as going from planet to planet.
What are what's the download speeds from the space station to Earth? I'm just curious.
Space station, we're actually we actually talk to our own what we call TDRS communication satellites, and in that pipe we have 300 to 600 megabits per second coming down.
Bad.
Space station. Yeah, it's a reasonable data rate.
But not when you're downloading buckets of data, though.
Correct. Yeah, and we've actually been testing even next generation laser communication systems. So we did another test where we shot a laser comm system that was in orbit around the moon back to Earth. And there we showed at nearly 1 gig per second transmission speed from the moon to Earth. That's pretty sporty, even by terrestrial terms. So
it is. Is any of that technology being leveraged for whatever lessons you're learning, testing this in space? Is any of that being commercialized here on Earth?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would say it's pretty synergistic both ways. I mean, we benefited from a lot of the advancement in fiber optic technology. And we're just now using a laser link to send that all the way back to Earth. Instead of sending it through a fiber, we're just doing straight laser light all the way back. And we're doing what they call photon detection. So we have to have really, really sensitive detectors and such. But it's actually not all that dissimilar to what you see in fiber optic technology terrestrially.
So, Jason, this is an enterprise technology podcast. What lessons do you think enterprises can learn from NASA and from the work that you all do?
Yeah, so I mean, I think what NASA has been going through is a pretty extreme transformation. If you look at the history of NASA, when we did things like Apollo in the beginning of the space program, there wasn't a space industry that was out there. So what we've done is, I mean, obviously built an industry by buying services, buying products and such over that. And as what we're seeing, though, is we're seeing kind of an ecosystem growing up around NASA. And instead of keeping shielded and trying to do everything the same way we used to do it, we're now embracing that kind of external community. And you can call it open innovation for some of the open innovation, like challenges and prizes platforms. But you can also look at how are we as an enterprise at NASA are now looking at commercial cargo services, buying services instead of operating launch vehicles and cargo vehicles. We're relying kind of on industry suppliers for that. Same thing with commercial crew and a crew transportation to low Earth orbit. Changing the way we acquire things in order to basically amortize prices over a larger user community. And we hope to build kind of that larger user community that's beyond NASA for low Earth orbit. And kind of turn over low Earth orbit and the flight of people and the kind of commerce that's done in low Earth orbit over to industry 100% as we move on into deep space. So I think the lesson is kind of adapting to the changing marketplace and going from a kind of an internal, internally hosted or solution kind of set to actually relying on the full enterprise application sets that are out there for the entire industry.
How bad of a day did you have, or your peers at NASA, when the SpaceX rocket exploded?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, we actually have had a failure of 3 different cargo flights in the past 8 months. Mm-hmm. SpaceX obviously was the one in the U.S. news the most, but we also lost Orbital nearly 8 months ago, out of Wallops, right after liftoff. It was destroyed off the launch pad. And then we lost a Russian Progress cargo vehicle as well. So when you start relying on external kind of operators that may have a different quality of service or kind of guarantee, you start changing the way you do risk management. So for us, we now look at risk management of cargo, not like on a single vehicle like the space shuttle, but now across a series of kind of cargo pipelines, be it SpaceX or Orbital or Russian partners, our European partners, or the Japanese, we have, just in that suite, we have over five vehicles, different cargo vehicles. So if we lose a vehicle and we find a design issue with one, we shift cargo to another one. We just manage our risk posture completely different. On SpaceX, obviously that was a loss of hardware and such, but it didn't put the space station at risk, because we just turned around and less than a week and a half later, we had a successful cargo flight for the Russians.
Yeah.
So I mean, it changes the way you operate.
Right. It's funny. I was in India. I think it was either October or November when the Mars satellite that they launched finally reached Mars. And it was like a national holiday in India. It was all over the news. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but obviously you got the point of what was going on in reading the English papers over there. How involved were you, or how involved was NASA with these other countries that have their own exploration programs?
Yeah, so right now NASA is still, if you look at the global space exploration budget, so how much money the world spends, we're still 50% of the entire world. So NASA and the U.S. is larger than the rest of the world combined. So we're still the major leader.
Yeah, India was touting how cheap they did it.
Yeah, so when we want to see kind of these emerging space countries like India, India's got great domestic launch vehicles that they've been progressing themselves with, actually without any help from the U.S. But now, as they're coming into their own on their space programs, is how can we now partner with them? And in fact, we partnered with their mission. We did some independent analysis on their trajectories, their flight plan, and such. And in fact, we launched our orbiter right before theirs, and they kind of followed each other out to Mars. And ours inserted, and theirs came right after it, several weeks after, and also got into orbit. And what happens there is, instead of us just flying the instruments that we wanted to fly, now we also share data with our partners in India, in this case, and we get more science done, we get more discoveries done, and we get to leverage each other's investments. And then what you see is the global community of space actually increases, and it's not just NASA, but you see this ecosystem growing, just like I was describing about commercial industry. You're now seeing a growth in international as well.
That's really interesting, Jason. You know, I'm also curious, you know, obviously there's like political conflicts with countries that we're also partnering with. I'm thinking of Russia specifically. How challenging does that make your job and the cooperation that NASA has with Russia when there's a obvious conflict going on?
So, I mean, conflicts are not new. So we started our cooperation with Russia when the Cold War is still occurring. So when you talk about the Mir space station, and we had our U.S. crew members going to the Mir space station, had space shuttle dockings with Mir as well, and all that. We've had conflicts in the past. What you see with the space industry, especially kind of a civilian space industry where human space flight and kind of advancement of science is, it kind of rises above the politics of the day that you see occurring. And we've been pretty immune to a lot of, even though there's a pretty significant political issues, we've been pretty immune to their impacts to cooperation and, when it comes to space. And in fact, I mean, obviously we're still cooperating strongly with the Russians. We operate the space station jointly with them. And we have redundancy and backup between them and us, and we count on their cargo and their crew vehicles, and it's really kind of this peaceful use of space for civilian and scientific advancement kind of does rise above the political issues, and we'll continue to see that even in the most recent skirmishes and disagreements that we've had. We haven't seen any significant change at all in cooperation.
I would like to know if you all got together and watched Gravity and brought popcorn and like laughed your asses off at the entire movie. Like, I want to know if that happened. If you had Gravity watching point and laugh parties.
So it's interesting with any Gravity or Interstellar or even The Martian that's going to be coming out this fall. you have kind of two camps. You can go into a movie expecting it to have every bit of scientific accuracy that you expect a real mission or something to have, or all the physics and every science to be correct.
Well, look, Interstellar is like the future, and there's parallel universes and whatever. So, like, that's, and it's Matthew McConaughey, and it can do no wrong. That's fine. But, like, Gravity, that's supposed to be, like, right here, right now.
Yeah, I mean, even then, I mean, or you can go to a movie and be entertained. And I would say Gravity was highly entertaining. There was tons of physics challenges, or as you saw the internet kind of explode about the physics of these objects not being able to hit each other, being able to survive in a spacesuit for that period of time and all that. And there's a lot of things they got right. I mean, some of the flames and some of the other things, and how does decompression in a spacesuit or in a habitat actually occur. A lot of those things they got right. The rest of it is for entertainment, and you just can't get too wound up about it.
True or false, you can float your way to a Chinese satellite.
That would probably be false.
Probably false. Yeah, true or false, you had a watching party and you pointed and laughed. Like, that's what I want to know.
You know, for me, I did not have any watching party. I actually did not watch it until almost a year after it was out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and maybe that's just a reflection of the lack of time to be able to watch movies with having young children.
I don't know how you had time to come on this podcast, Jason.
Jason, before we let you go, I got to ask you one last question. Do you train the astronauts for Planet of the Apes scenario?
Which scenario is that?
Well, coming back and there's no humans, just monkeys.
It could happen.
You know,
or a World War Z scenario. That's another great NASA.
You know, at the end of those spacecraft up there are operated by a lot of people here on the ground too. So I think they would know a little bit ahead of time.
They probably would. You know, it's funny. We had Chris Kemp on an old podcast, and Chris jokingly, I think he was serious, told us that on some of the NASA laptops, they used to save alien pictures on the laptops in case people would find it, just to kind of be funny. Is that true?
That was probably Chris being Chris. although that's a pretty good idea. Finding a NASA laptop these days that's unencrypted might be a bit of a challenge, though. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think we challenge you, Jason.
Yeah, you should put alien pictures on your – what is your screensaver?
What is my screensaver?
Yeah.
Actually, nothing special at all. I have just a standard Apple screensaver. It's not that exciting.
Not that exciting. Jason, this is really fantastic. Thank you so much. And people don't know this, behind the scenes, you're a big supporter of the podcast. So thank you very much. And really fantastic. How can people stalk you online, Jason?
Well, my Twitter handle is just Jason Cruzan, Crusan. And you can find me on Twitter there and follow us there.
Do you do any blogging?
I don't. But we do have a Facebook page for my group and all those kind of things. And I tweet about the different projects we have going on a regular basis and the different testing. We have a new kind of drilling robot that could actually prospect for that water I was talking about. We're actually testing that at later this year in September, October timeframe. And we're actually putting that robot together right now. And we've been posting pictures and video about that and all those kinds of things. Actually, Twitter's the best way to follow it.
That's great. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming on this week. Sarah, as always, thank you. Apologies to Fred Nix. We couldn't get to you this week.
Sorry,
we'll
Fred.
See everybody next week. Thanks.
Bye.